You know, these days, we all wear our politics on our sleeves, and it seems like if you're pro-environment, then you must be anti-American, or you must be at least a pseudo-commie. And I always think when I hear those kinds of comments about Teddy Roosevelt, not exactly a guy who was a pinko, lefty, panty-waist type guy, crying and wailing about saving a couple of trees. I mean, he was a hunter, an outdoorsman, a big, strapping, strong guy, a conservative, a Republican, who became our first environmental president, establishing national parks and speaking about preserving special areas. Certainly nothing wrong with that. Certainly nothing anti-American or anti-capitalist about it. There has to be a better way. When we come back, we'll get into our continue our conversation with Elaine Smith, author of Screwing Mother Nature for Profit. One of the things we'll touch on is what happened to the electric car? Because it sure seems like we have the technology to do this. So where is it? What happened to it? We continue our conversation, and we'll opening up the phone lines right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Elaine, you mentioned, you touch on this in your book about Tesla's inventions and about the Tesla Motor Corporation, electric cars, and what could be if the market worked free and unfettered as we hope that it does. Talk to me about what has happened to electric cars, why the market hasn't brought them to the fore, why we don't have them, and why we aren't driving around in them right now.
Well,
more than we are, that is.
Yeah, there was a film put out called Who Killed the Electric Car? And a friend of mine told me it was showing in the next town, so I drove over there and saw it, and I just was flabbergasted. I thought, oh my gosh, what they're doing, taking the electric cars, which would be gas-free, and they collapsed them. They took them and crushed them, and the people wanted them, and I mean, it was just like craziness. So the electric car would be a really popular thing if they could allow that to happen. But General Motors, their reputation was kind of got into trouble because of that innovative electric car, and came out 10 years after it came on the market in 1996. It was only leased. They would never sell it, but they recalled all of those cars except one, and they put them into these places where they crush all the cars. They have the crushers, and they took all those cars and just destroyed them. Now, that is insane to do that. They were trying to preserve their market, but it made people really angry. So, you know, why would the automobile industry destroy products that everybody loves? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, you know? But then that film that came out, Who Killed the Electric Car, was very revelatory because it exposed the this control of the products and they didn't want to get outside of their comfort zones. And then there was collusion with the oil companies, and because the oil companies were going to lose money if they had the electric cars. And so it was like a whole big conflict there. We don't want to change. We're going to stay the same as it has been. So,
help me to understand this, though. Why doesn't the market fix that? Capitalism cures all ills. If it works freely and unfettered, it should bring these products to the market if the public is demanding it. I mean, it seems like the public has been asking for electric cars a long time, that with the price of oil going up and down, mostly up, that it would make sense, that it could be competitive. We now have some electric car options, but it seems like it's too little and way too late.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just the oil companies. They're the ones who don't want this to happen because then they're going to lose all their revenue. I mean, we have to look at the revenue stream. That's kind of driving the whole thing. But, I'd love to have an electric car myself. And I have a couple of friends who have had them in the past, but it's kind of too bad because they crushed all of them. They crushed all of those, and they took them to the Arizona desert, and they crushed them over there. And so the oil companies were having a fit, and then these companies were going to lose the revenue from the cars that they had already built. And this was going to transform the way we travel, is by having a different kind of a vehicle energy source. So the oil companies were very much opposed to that. And then some of the automobile companies didn't like it either. I mean, it's just got to be a big, humongous mess.
I remember there was a senator, Richard Bryan. He was a U.S. senator from Nevada here, somebody I still know, a courageous guy who took on the idea of fuel efficiency in American cars. And it was his cause in the U.S. Senate during the two terms he served there, trying to get the automakers to make it more efficient, to improve mileage in American-made cars. The technology exists. We know it exists because we see it in cars that are sold everywhere else in the world. And yet American automakers said, oh, we can't do this. They fought it tooth and nail. He got tiny increases in fuel efficiency standards, but nothing close to what he thought they should and could achieve. And I think it just shows the power of the oil industries, the power of the auto industries. And in our government right now, it's hard to get anything meaningful done.
It's true. It's true. So, but I think people want the electric car. They would like to have it. I mean, Tesla has an electric roadster, for Tesla Motors, and Elon Musk has one of those. He was co-founded that, but he drives around in that. So, and he's the president of PayPal, founder of PayPal. So I think that we're looking at collusion here, where companies don't want to have us have the things that will really save our money, save our resources, the wear and tear, the maintenance, and all of that. They want to keep the same engine of automotive industry moving along the same line. They don't want to change. So, I mean, I think we're dealing with a lot of recalcitrant corporations.
Talk to me for a couple of minutes before we open up the phone lines about your take on this whole thing, how it needs to change. I mean, you give some examples in the book, Screwing Mother Nature for Profit, of some companies that somehow suddenly or organically develop some kind of a conscience and turn things around. The ability to still make a profit, to take care of their employees, and to take care of the environment.
Well, some of them are getting to that place where they're recognizing that they can't continue the way they have been. The protest is pretty much too high. I noticed that last year or so, I went and checked out the Ford Motor Company cars. Just for instance, I said, I want to see what's underneath the hood. Well, no owner could do anything inside of that car anymore under the hood. You know, where you used to be able to change your oil and make, do these things under the hood very easily. But now the new cars are not that way at all. You have to take them into the shop, and most of the shops are charging like $90 for you just get in to have your oil changed and all the rest of that. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I think they're trying to control the market. But if the people just absolutely refuse to buy those cars or to buy used cars instead and keep those going, then the new cars are just going to sit there, which isn't going to be good for their industry. So somehow, the public needs to take, and I think they are doing it in a subtle way, but maybe not a conscious effort, is to retaliate against some of these things that we know are not serving the environment or our own pocketbook, and redesign the way we do things. I mean, we keep recycling the same thing over, over and over every year, and we have to stop and say, wait a minute, we're going to do something different now. And I think that's why Tesla, Elon Musk is making, he's been more progressive in that area with a car. But we can do that on our own level of paying more attention to what we're doing instead of just running out to the nearest place and getting whatever they have. In other words, the buyers need to be more conscious. They need to do their research, and they need to consider the outcome for the environment. Look, if we don't have clean air, we're all going to be sick. And we can see that happening in some areas. So if we begin to be conscious about our own environment, our own home, and purchasing items that are very that are recyclable, that will serve us well, that will be long-lasting and not something you're just going to buy today and throw away tomorrow, I think the consumer needs to be more aware of that. I mean, I went over to one of the Ford dealers, and I said, just show me some of this other stuff that you've got here, you know. Oh, we've got this and this and this and this. And I said, well, I don't need those things. Oh, yeah, but it comes with it, you know. And I said, that doesn't matter. It's not what I want. And I think that as consumers, we can be more expressive of our desires when we go in and talk to these people and say, this is what I really would like to do. Can you do that? can you get somebody there to do this, to design this, to create this? I mean, Henry Ford did it in the very beginning. He created the automobile. So somehow we need to be more responsible for ourselves, paying more attention to what we're doing in our homes, around our homes, the things that we're buying, and buying thinkingly, thinking very clearly about whether this is going to last, whether it's worth the amount of money, or whether it's going to collapse and break or whatever in a very short time. And the consumer has control. They have control of themselves. All they have to do is start emulating the ideal of what they really want and make
okay, examples. Examples of companies that have turned things around.
Oh, gosh.
Starbucks, you mentioned in your book, right?
Yeah, Starbucks. Yeah, well, they've become very conscious. And they started putting these coffee places in grocery stores and stuff, so they didn't have to go out and rent a regular space of their own, which was helpful for the grocery store, and the consumer really liked that. So, yes, so they have been doing a lot of things. I think that company is pretty conscious about
it. And sharing profits with the employees.
Yes,
or stock,
that started in the very beginning when the company was formed, and he had to borrow money, and so he made his employees part of the system so that they would get money out of it. So they're paid them to invest. So that's worked out very well for them. I mean, look how much Starbucks they have.
Boeing is another example you mentioned in the book.
Yeah, Boeing too. They're more conscious too. I have a friend who worked for Boeing, and he had nothing but really good comments to make about the company. But I think all these companies, of course, we have a lot of airline things going on here in Seattle with the companies. But I think when we can do that, when we can be more conscious about what we're doing, then, and Boeing is doing a good thing on that. They've had their times back and forth too.
Yeah, here's another example you use in the book is Whole Foods, and I shop at Whole Foods now and then. I like Whole Foods; it offers some great stuff. But if everybody had to shop at Whole Foods, families that are struggling to make ends meet, it'd be really tough. It's expensive. What do you say to somebody like? How do you tell them don't shop at Walmart? I mean, that company contributes a huge percentage of our national trade deficit because most of what it sells comes from China. How do you tell a family, don't buy there because it's cheaper stuff? You're just going to have to buy more expensive stuff somewhere else.
Well, that's probably true. Walmart does discount things pretty well there, but of course they have a huge, when they're buying in large quantities, so they obviously get much better prices that way. Yes, Walmart has been a challenge, that's for sure. But I do think we have places where they can have buy the food, healthy food from not Walmart but other places, and they are. I mean, I've looked around. We have a company here that is kind of new. It's been here about a year or so, and they I had never been into their store, but I went in and oh my God, I couldn't believe what they had. And they had all these fresh vegetables and everything, and the prices were very, very good. So I can look around and see what you can find. In other words, you be conscious about the things that you're buying and be conscious about where you're shopping. And this takes responsibility for self to do that. And if you have organic places, we have in the summertime, we have our farmers market here, and the farmers from all over come and bring their fresh foods. And I tell you, it is a jam. You have a hard time finding a place to park. And very, very popular. It's been on, I don't know, 20 years they've been going. So, but home farmers come down there and sell their goods. And so it's a matter of consciousness, honest to goodness, it really does. You have to be conscious about what you're buying, what you're paying, where you're shopping, what you're feeding your body, and what you're feeding your family. So it takes a different set mindset. You have to think differently. It's not, I'm just going to go run to the store and get blah, blah. It's, am I going to get the organic? Am I going to get the homegrown? Am I going to get the healthy food? It's a matter of changing our perception of shopping and becoming more responsible.
So basically use the power of capitalism through consumerism to force corporations to change.
Exactly. And that has happened, yes. And that can happen. So if the people will start taking control and paying attention, asking questions, maybe saying to the grocer, well, I don't know why you have this because it's X number of dollars more than I can buy it someplace else, and theirs is natural. Who are you buying from? I've noticed that some of these grocery stores here are starting to buy from local farmers. And, you know, you tell them, I don't want any of these things that are contaminated with all these extra genes and stuff they're putting in the foods. The consumer, if they fought back and said, I'm not buying this because of you're not having really healthy food, then they will change. The grocers, you guaranteed, will change their ways.
Okay, Elaine Smith, we're going to go to the phones. I know these are emotional issues. We're going to let people say whatever they want. I just hope we all keep it on an even keel here. West of the Rockies, interesting guy, Michael, lives in Oregon, but he's lived in the Amazon. He's lived in socialist and communist countries. He's a logger, so he sees this stuff from a lot of different viewpoints. Michael, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Okay. Yeah, I have some opposing views. And, you know, I'd like to take the time to express some of them. To
hey, Michael, it's good. Just let you know that in about 3 minutes, we're going to take a break. So if we need to, we'll carry you over to the across the break. But go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, I've been a landscaper. I've been a gardener. I've been a lot of things involved with the environment. And I had the opportunity to move to Mato Grosso, Brazil. I lived in the Amazon there. We had a 7,000-acre fazenda, raw, bare land of jungle, which we walked into, and we had to create our own environment, our own lifestyle there. I will say one thing. There's a lot of this stuff that I hear about the Amazon being cut down, and it sounds like it's being ruined. Not so. If you lived in the jungle where I did, one of the worst possible things was you cut it down, because I cleared, let's say, 40 acres for myself. The biggest problem was you turn your back and it grows back. It just grows, and you have to actually hire people to go in there every 3 months and hack it down so that you're, I grew coffee in Guaraná and pasture for some cattle. And the jungles that we lived in, I'll tell you, it was, it's talking about, they do, when you forest out the bigger timber, you know, they do cut down a lot of the trees, and they burn that because they go in and plant, and that's what they create their farms on and feed their families and what have. But that smoke goes into the air, and people say, what's polluting it? Well, again, in the Amazon, it rains about 5 times a day. And if there's anything in the air, believe me, within an hour, it's usually washed away. But
so
you
think that slash and burn agriculture, there's nothing wrong with that? That's okay.
Well, they've been doing it for centuries, and I would say there's really possibly other ways to do it. But when you go to clear, let's say, 40 acres, there's just nothing to do with the timber. I mean, it's not big timber. Most of it's small. Five inch round diameter things that are just piled up, you know, 10 feet high. So yes, they burn it because there's nothing else to do with it to get in order to get to the ground where they can create a farm for themselves, and they have their families. And in regards to the natives, I flew around Amazon with the Wycliffe Institute, and we picked up natives from different parts of Amazon, and I will say, yeah, there's natives there that have particular plants that they care for. We ourselves use some of the native plants for different purposes, but I will say that very seldom do any of that be able to cure some of the diseases that they had.
Hey, Michael, hang on a second. Interesting viewpoint here. I want to get Elaine's take on what you're saying, but we're going to have to do it on the other side of the break, so hang on with us. We're talking with Elaine Smith, the author of Screwing Mother Nature for Profit. We're talking with Elaine Smith, the author of Screwing Mother Nature for Profit, getting some pretty interesting insight from Michael in Oregon, who says he lived in the Amazon and things are not quite as bad as they've been made to be. We'll pick up Michael's conversation right after this and get to as many of your other calls as we can on Coast to Coast AM. I promised Michael, our caller on the West of the Rockies line, a chance to wrap up his comments, and we'll get Elaine Smith to respond. Michael?
Okay. you know, I'm not in disagreement in entirety with everything that's going on in the Amazon jungle. I will say Brazil, even though it's represented as a democratic country, it has a shadow government, military government behind the scenes, and it's one of the most corrupt countries on earth as far as I'm concerned, because I lived there and I had to deal with them. So in this corruption, you know, you have greed and everything else that goes on, but you have also a lot of technology that's taking place trying to deal with some of these situations. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. But I tend to listen to the environmentalists, and they're always painting it as a real negative, disastrous situation, and I don't believe it. So when you get in an airplane and you fly over Brazil, you go for hours and hours and hours, like an ocean of green. I mean, and you see our farm, we had 7,000 acres, and we only cleared about 500 acres. And it was like a postage stamp on this ocean.
Okay,
anyway,
Michael.
Let me go to one other situation here. And she was mentioning capitalism, and put it in a little bit negative. I don't really care one way or the other about capitalism or socialism, but I lived in Armenia, and I lived in Russia. Okay, now, I don't know if she's ever heard of the Lake Baikal, but it's one of the biggest freshwater sources on Earth. Well, this beautiful communist government went and dumped their live reactors from their submarines, atomic reactors, into that lake, you know, to dispose of them. Okay, now, where was their beautiful communist mentality versus the capitalist mentality?
I think you're setting up, Michael, I have to honestly say, I think you're setting up a false dichotomy there, is that Elaine is not here to defend socialist or communist governments. She's here to say that capitalist companies, corporations, could act better than they do. But I appreciate your input so far. I wouldn't give her a chance to respond. Elaine, basically, Michael is telling us that things in the Amazon are not nearly as dire as has been presented in the media and perhaps by you.
Well, I'm not saying that the whole Amazon is involved in all of this. I do know that there are some corporations that are going into the Amazon, and they are deriving new drugs for AIDS and diabetes and arthritis and Alzheimer's, and even muscle relaxants and steroids and cancer drugs. Now, they say there's only about 25% of possible cures, and only 1% have been tested. So the fact is that they are going in and they're doing this, I mean, which is beneficial for humankind. And I think that when they are, you know, taking things away that don't provide that, then I think then maybe you know, they can use it for planting and so forth, but not to go in and wholesale take things away. So, I mean, but we have that in other areas as well.
But your basic message is, look, it would make sense for them to be good corporate citizens, these companies that do business down there, and have sustainable profits versus highest possible returns now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Yes. First-time caller, Devin in Mill Creek, Washington. Hi, Devin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just got, being a local Washington person myself, I figured I'd lead in with a bit of a story and then drop two questions real quick, if that's all right.
Okay.
All right. Well, when I was growing up, my father was always the kind of person who, when he would take out his frustrations, he'd take it out on me. Needless to say, once I got older and started getting into the workforce, I realized that my knee would be an ongoing problem. And I tried different medications, I tried different physical therapies, and I found that marijuana was one of the few things that actually did help. It reduced my pain, allowed me to move around, and I'm curious what your guest stance is on the use of medical marijuana as well as hemp as a renewable resource.
Elaine?
Oh, well, I agree. I agree.
Do you want to elaborate more than that? I mean, the hemp part of it or the use of medical marijuana? Which part or both parts?
Well, I just think that why not use medical marijuana? I think it's silly not to. I mean, because it is healing people and is helpful. So that's one thing I think that could obviously be taken care of. But, basically when we're talking about, you know, in the Amazon and so forth, is taking too much advantage of the environment. But from your other caller, you know, it sounds like some of those companies are more responsible than others.
Back to this marijuana thing, is it part of, it's sort of your general philosophy that maybe marijuana is outlawed because of corporate interests, that liquor companies
I think
something?
I think the drug companies. they don't want it because people would get well.
And in general, you make that point in the book a couple of times that the drug companies would prefer to have us sick.
Right. Well, they don't make any money if we're not sick.
Devin, I don't know if Devin is gone. Is he gone? Devin, is it? Did you had one other point you wanted to make?
I was curious how both of you guys felt as far as the banning of hemp. Even obviously, it has no psychoactive effects on it. And the sheer fact that it seems like there are a lot of corporations that would like to keep this amazing resource down.
Elaine? For all the reasons that I said. They would like to repress something because they can make more money on something else.
Yeah, I mean, I've read, I don't know a lot about it, but I've read quite a bit on the benefits of hemp, what it does to the soil and its benefits as a all the products it can be used in. It seems to make a lot of sense. Why capitalism, some good corporation, doesn't take advantage of that? I guess some do, but many don't. And I think it's a stacked deck has got to be the reason. A paranoia about the pharmaceutical effects of it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see it all made legal.
All right, Devin, thanks for the call. Jess in College Station, Texas, on the Wild Card Line. Been holding for a while. Hi, Jess. How you doing?
Hey, George. It's an honor, and thank you as a longtime listener for keeping Art Bell's legacy alive. I wanted to tell you that. Respectfully, I wanted to take a little bit of issue with a few of the guests' assertions. I studied economics in college, and I own a small business, so I'm not an expert, but I've certainly got a little bit of experience in the area. A few of the things that she's attributing to capitalism, I think, are just flat-out false. Going back to the Amazon example, the Amazon, as well as you could even say African oil leases, are oftentimes a great, great example of government corruption, not so much capitalism gone wrong, because what happens is these third-world governments own a majority of the land. They own the rainforests in Africa. They own the large leases where the oil companies drill. And so the governments actually dole out special favors because they want as much money as possible in the hands of the highest top administrators in the government. So the governments actually are the greedy ones, if you want to use that term, and they are the corrupt ones that create the problems because they don't understand the meaning of private property. But I wanted to make another point, George.
Well, hold on. That's a pretty good one. You want to talk about that for a second before you move on? Because that's a pretty good point. I mean, there are some pretty corrupt governments.
If she wants to assert it, I mean, and George, I'll even go one further than that. If you talk about oil in the Middle East, the general oil market, who controls oil in the Middle East? It's not the oil companies. It's OPEC. It's governments, government bureaucracies, because the government administrators are just money hungry. And you really see that in Africa, where all of the oil company revenue virtually goes to the governments because they give exclusive use of the land. That's not the company's fault. They're just out to make a profit. That's really more in the hands of government. So, yes, if she'd like to address that, but I do have one other point. Thank you, George.
Sure. Elaine?
Oh, I don't have any argument with what he said.
I don't either. I would say that it's both. I mean, it's corrupt governments welcoming in corrupting companies that are more than happy to pay bribes under the table and exploit the resources. I think your point is well taken, Jess, but I think it's not just governments or just corporations. It's both of them.
No, absolutely. But I mean, the point I made, George, is you can't really call that capitalism because it's not. It's special favoritism from government. It's government corruption. That's the base of the problem. But I wanted to go back to something that she said very, very early on. I listened to the entire interview, and she is really a wonderful guest, and she's very smart. I think she's a great sociologist. I'm not so sure about her economics ideas, but you know, she was talking about Papua New Guinea at the very beginning of your interview, and she was talking about how these people grow their own food, they make their own clothes, and, you know, then the companies come in and things kind of get warped, and then they march on the demonstrate against the companies. And, you know, I think there's a phenomenon, George, that we have in Western civilization, Western society, where a lot of people like us who are on the radio, which is an innovation of capitalism, but we're in rich countries, and a lot of people in rich countries look at these natives in poor countries, whether it's in Africa or, you know, the Pacific or wherever, And we say, oh, good, gosh, you know, look at these people who are making their own food and their clothes and so forth, and they're so austere, and their lives are so green and carbon neutral and so on and so forth. And there's a good point to be had there. I mean, we could certainly learn from austerity, and money's not everything. But I think it's also worth pointing out, these people are living in abject poverty. They have extremely high infant death rates. They have very short lifespans, rampant disease. And yes, they may grow their own food and make their own clothes, but their bathroom facilities are very frequently going to be right near where the food comes from. You know, I think it's worth noting, George, that although we certainly want to be careful with the environment, and I'm not against the environment in any way, very, very much in favor of being careful with the environment. But I think we need to remember that at the end of the day, the greatest increase in the human condition through history has been in those times and those places where people have been free to start their own firms, to make a profit, to trade freely with others. And those areas, those times, have the longest lifespans, the lowest infant death rates, poverty becomes the rarest, people are the richest, and we have innovation.
I got you. I think those are good points. Here's the question for you and the point that Elaine would make. What's the reason that the companies, the corporations doing business in New Guinea have to poison the water supply? Whether or not those guys live as long as we do here in the U.S., why not have a more responsible approach to extracting the resources from there without wiping out their way of life?
George?
Yeah.
Okay, I would like to actually address that, because that is a really good point. That is not true capitalism. That is what's called externality. Some people call it market failure, but either one's used by economists. What it is that when somebody imposes a negative effect on somebody else in a free economy, that is not true capitalism, because there's not a voluntary trade. Capitalism.
Okay, well, again, why can't corporations doing business there do a better job of it, whether it's true capitalism or not?
The corporation has an incentive to make money. So you can look at the corporation and say, yes, they shouldn't do this. But really, it's the government's job to preserve a free capitalist economy with the correct regulations and the correct safeguards against people being taken advantage of. That's not the fault necessarily of the corporation. Again, the base problem is that the governments don't understand where to regulate. They may be all caught up in trying to get aid from the IMF or participate in certain social programs, and many of these third world countries try to do that and raise the standard of living that way. But the best way to raise the standard of living is to make sure that corporations are playing in a free marketplace, and that people's rights are protected. These countries don't protect people's rights, and that's why externalities run wild. But that's
well, Jess, you would be saying then that some of these governments have to get these corporations doing business in their countries under control. And I'm not sure that all free market capitalists would agree with you. But let me let Elaine get into this. We haven't heard from her in a while.
Well, in the first place, I'm not even talking about capitalism. I mean, this is several of your callers have been talking about capitalism. I'm not really focused so much on that. So I do know that some of these companies are doing some good things over there, but they are also not doing things good. So it's kind of a if or in terms of their behavior. And I mean, the story about Papua New Guinea, that was on the front page of the New York Times, so it wasn't anything that I, you know, saw when I was over there. It happened after I was there.
Okay, Jess, good points, I think. Yeah, we have used some of these terms interchangeably, talking about corporations and corporate behavior, which is not necessarily an indictment of capitalism. It's just that Elaine is calling for a more responsible behavior on the part of corporations and wants we consumers to make them adhere to it. But thanks for the call. Good points. Try to get one more in. John in Astoria, Oregon. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I agree with your guest in principle, certainly. I have to say that her thing about the electric car is a total scam. Okay, and I'll tell you why. Electric cars are not efficient because, you know, they're getting the energy one way or another. You have to burn oil in a power plant or nuclear energy or whatever to recharge the battery. Plus, you have a lot of pollution created in the manufacture of the electric car. And electric cars are only about 30% efficient. Now, I have the solution to this problem, and I have my life destroyed for it, okay? I have an engineering background, and I have an extensive automotive background. I used to build racing engines for a living, okay? I built a carburetor, and I put it on a one-ton Chevy dually dump truck, okay? It normally got about 8 or 9 miles to the gallon. And with this carburetor, which I made out of used carburetor parts and scrap metal, okay, this is like sixth grade engineering, okay, I got 65 miles to the gallon.
John, how was your life destroyed? Let's just boil it down to this. Was it destroyed by corporate interests who didn't want your carburetor on the market?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. It was all done covertly, and I never got any answers. But I did have my house burned to the ground. I had several attempts on my life. Was constantly arrested. My shop broken into. All my prototypes stolen. Everything. Okay.
Wouldn't you say that that sort of fits into the scenario that Elaine has been talking about and discusses in her book, that innovation is stifled by corporations that don't want the competition? And I'm going to let Elaine weigh in on this because we're running out of time. Elaine?
Well, yes, I think what you've just paraphrased is exactly right. And I'm so sorry that you had that problem with your house and everything, because that's certainly not the kind of behavior that we would like to have in business dealings. I mean, that just shows that they don't want it done and they think that you're going to corrupt their model. I mean, they're fighting for their own survival, and change does not come easily.
Hey, John, send me an email. I'd like to hear more about your story, and maybe we can talk about it sometime offline. But I guess, you know, I think that that's an example of exactly what you're talking about, that just because you build a better mousetrap does not mean that the world beats a path to your door, that that corporations not being responsible will stifle innovation like that.
Yep, you got it.
We've got about a minute left. Elaine, you want to say anything else that sort of sums up your book?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share this knowledge with your audience. And there's a lot more to the book than just what we were talking about as well. So things about being able to take better care of yourself and stay healthy, and some tools that can help with that. And also some business models that have been very successful. And, they're always looking for a new model for business. And there are some things that are mentioned in here. And I think that it would be very useful, for interesting to learn more about that. And it certainly has rounded out my education.
Well, thank you very much, Elaine, for coming on. Elaine Smith, her book is called Screwing Mother Nature for Profit. There's a lot of stuff in there, a lot we didn't get a chance to get into, about an overall consciousness and how a change in consciousness, maybe we have to impose it on some of these big corporations, but how corporations can be effective and responsible citizens and take care of their workers, take care of their environment, and still make a decent profit. And she's got a lot of examples of that in the book. Coming up in a moment, thanks, Elaine, for being on the program. Coming up in a moment, we switch gears with my guest, Ryan Holiday. He's the author of a new book called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. And it sort of goes hand in hand with some of the topics we've discussed for the first 2 hours, the ability of corporations to manipulate our lives and the consequences of that for all of us here. We'll pick it up with Ryan Holiday after the break, right after this on Coast to Coast AM.